Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Storm surge. Hurricane Ian batters Cuba and then gains momentum as it heads toward Florida, triggering evacuation orders for millions of residents. Then widespread unrest. Iran cracks down on demonstrators protesting the death of a young woman in police custody. And continuing education. Four-year institutions try to make it easier for students to transfer from community colleges in hopes of boosting enrollment.
I didn't actually have to fill out any applications to come to George Mason. They did all of the paperwork for me. All I had to do was just keep my good grades.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Hurricane Ian is bulking up again and bearing down on Florida's west coast. The storm lost some punch over western Cuba today and then began regaining strength. It could bring 130-mile-an-hour winds, 18 inches of rain, and a 12-foot ocean surge to Florida later tomorrow. William Brangham begins our coverage.
Along Florida's Gulf Coast today, they're preparing for the worst, bracing for what forecasters say could be a potentially historic catastrophe.
We're at least 100 meters from the beach. We're trying to take precautions for damages, but they're unavoidable, especially when a hurricane unleashes the force that it does.
Across the state, shelves were emptied of water and needed supplies, while long lines grew to fill sandbags for a last line of defense. Those who aren't hunkering down took to the roads. Today, more than 2.5 million Floridians are under some kind of evacuation order.
It is going to kick up a lot of water as it comes in.
From Sarasota, Governor Ron DeSantis said it was not too late to act.
And you don't need to evacuate to another state. You don't need to evacuate hundreds of miles away. The key is to get to high ground and be in a safe structure.
And at the White House, President Biden urged Americans to follow official guidance.
The citizens in the potential impact area should obey the instructions of local officials. Evacuate when ordered and be prepared for the storm when it comes.
Earlier today, Ian ripped through western Cuba with fierce rain and strong winds, striking the tobacco-growing province of Piña del Río. It's forced tens of thousands to evacuate and cut power to over a million more. Others chose to stay put and ride out the heavy conditions.
Yes, I am worried, but work is work, and I'm a security guard, so I need to go to work whether there's lightning, thunder, or rain.
After passing Cuba, Ian is expected to intensify into a larger, more powerful storm as it feeds on the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Because of global climate change, sea levels are higher and, in some places, warmer, both of which can add additional fuel to storms. Forecasters warn the coast from Fort Myers to the Tampa Bay region are most at risk of life-threatening storm surge. Tampa, which is home to more than 3 million people, is particularly exposed. Much of it sits on low-lying ground and has seen rapid development along the coast in recent years, a combination which makes it one of the most storm-vulnerable cities on Earth. Tonight, with their homes boarded, many residents can do little but wait and hope. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
The approach of Ian prompted rescheduling of various sporting events, and the January 6th committee in Congress cited the storm as it canceled tomorrow's planned hearing in Washington. Now for the latest on the hurricane's projected path and the risks ahead, I'm joined by Jamie Rome. He's the acting director of the National Hurricane Center. Jamie Rome, welcome to the NewsHour. So tell us right now, what is the location, the latest information you have on the location of this storm and its trajectory as you see it?
Yeah, as of 5 o'clock, Ian is located about 230 miles south of Sarasota. So it's really starting to close in on Florida. Movement is off to the north at 10 miles per hour, but it's going to start to slow down as it approaches and moves over the state. It is a Category 3 hurricane on the Saffir-Simpson scale. That's maximum sustained winds of 120 miles per hour. And unfortunately, it's looking like a multi-hazard event is going to unfold as this relatively large hurricane sweeps across the Florida Peninsula. We're going to have heavy rains and flooding inland, really significant and potentially life-threatening storm surge down around the southwestern coast of Florida. So this is south of Tampa, down around Fort Myers, Port Charlotte area. A band of heavy rain developing along the I-4 corridor, and then not to be left out is the damaging wind as the core of the hurricane moves inland and across the state.
And so when you say multi-hazard catastrophe, what does that mean for the people who live in Florida? Who should be thinking about evacuating? How far inland? And who should just basically be hunkering down?
It's actually a very good question. Thank you for asking it. We evacuate in this country because of storm surge. So if you're in a storm surge evacuation zone or a hurricane evacuation zone and you've been ordered to evacuate, then you must do so. If you're not in a hurricane evacuation zone, then you should probably stay put unless you're not in a well-built home. So if you're in a mobile home or an RV or something like that, that's different. But if you're in a well-built home and you're not within the evacuation order, you should probably hunker down and stay put.
And so is that message getting out to the people who need to hear it?
I actually think so. The lead time on this particular system was really historic. I've been here for 23 years, and I was really just struck by the fact that we were able to predict a major hurricane days in advance. Developing over the Northwest Caribbean and then moving into the eastern Gulf of Mexico, I can remember a time when that forecast would not have been possible. So I really think that people have been hearing the message and taking action.
And when we just heard in that report from my colleague William Brangham about the Tampa area being particularly vulnerable, what is it about that part of Florida that makes it so vulnerable?
It's actually the entire west coast of Florida. Everyone likes to focus on Tampa, but it's the entire west coast of Florida. And owing to how this system is going to come inland, we think the peak surge is going to be somewhere down here, maybe closer to the Fort Myers area versus Tampa. But Tampa is going to get the heavy rain shield, so the heavy precipitation and flooding from heavy rains.
Well, we are going to be watching it very closely, and I know you certainly are too. Jamie Rome, we thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now let's hear more about the preparations and the concerns in the Tampa area. William Brangham is back with that.
As we've been reporting, major evacuations are continuing this evening, and officials are warning about a significant storm surge that could hit Tampa and southwest Florida very hard. Jane Castor is the mayor of Tampa, and she joins me now from the Emergency Operations Center in that city. Mayor Castor, thank you so much for being here. Could you just give us a sense of how preparations are going right now?
Well, actually, we are finished with our preparations. We've been in that for quite some time, but we have called for a mandatory evacuation in Zone A. For those who aren't familiar with Tampa, we have over 120 miles of coastline just in our city. So Zone A is really those individuals that are in close proximity to the water. So we've evacuated individuals in that zone. We've given over 50,000 sandbags out. We have prepared as much as we possibly can here in the city of Tampa. Our residents are heeding the warnings, and they are leaving for higher ground. We've told them, you don't have to leave the state. We just need you to get up to higher ground out of the storm surge, which at this point is still anticipated to be anywhere between 10 and 15 feet, which is simply catastrophic.
Indeed. I want to ask you about those evacuations, because the head of FEMA today echoed a concern that some people share that residents may not heed those warnings, in part because it feels like, especially along the Gulf Coast, there's warnings quite often, and the residents of your city may not have had much experience with a direct hurricane coming into their neighborhood. Are you confident that people are going to heed the warning and get out while they can?
Yes, from all indications that we've seen, on our interstates, on our expressways, individuals are leaving northward and easterly out of the city of Tampa. And I think that looking at the severity of the hurricanes over the last couple of years, even the most seasoned of us Floridians understand that a 10 to 15 foot tidal surge is something that you don't need to take for granted, and you certainly don't to see need to see if you can ride that out. As for the newer residents in our community, hopefully they will heed that warning as well and understand that this is not something that we should wait and see what happens. We need to get out of the way of this. As we like to say, you hide from the wind and run from the water. And so we're trying to get everyone out of the way of that storm surge.
As you well know, much of your city is very low-lying, and there has been a lot of development right up along the coast because everyone loves to live near the beach. And those two factors, the low-lying and the lots of people living near the water, makes your city one of the most vulnerable, what's considered one of the most vulnerable cities to this kind of storm surge. How much does that worry you, that this really could be an unprecedented event for your city?
Well, that certainly is a concern for me. But what is most concerning is really our geographic layout in the Tampa Bay area. Our bay is very, very shallow. And so the original predictions of Hurricane Ian stalling right outside of Tampa Bay for anywhere from 24 to 48 hours, dropping 20 to 30 inches of rain on us with 10 to 15 foot tidal surges was really nothing short of catastrophic. So that concerns me a lot more than the development or the idea that individuals aren't going to get out of harm's way.
I know you spoke with President Biden. You were among several mayors who spoke with him earlier today. What did you convey to him about what you most need now and what you might most need later?
Well, I first and foremost conveyed my appreciation. We have had incredible collaboration, not only on the local level here in the Tampa Bay with our partners in Hillsborough County, but in the state, too, with the state emergency manager and on the federal level with FEMA. Everybody has been very collaborative. They have resources staged all over. So we have, as far as governmental resources, we either have them here in our community or they're being staged and they're available. And then talking to our private partners, with our electric companies, talking to the communications providers, gas companies, just making sure that everybody has those resources pre-positioned to be in here as soon as the wind stops blowing.
Mayor Jane Castor of Tampa, Florida, we wish you all the best and hope this you all get through this storm okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
In the day's other news, voting concluded in Russian-occupied regions of Ukraine, and pro-Moscow officials say that all four voted to formally join Russia. The announcement followed hours of counting ballots in hastily arranged referenda that much of the world had rejected. Ukraine's president also dismissed the vote in translated remarks to the UN Security Council.
This is an attempt to steal the territory of another state. This is a very cynical attempt to force the male population in the occupied territory of Ukraine to mobilize into the Russian army in order to send them to fight against their own homeland.
Meanwhile, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev insisted that Moscow is not bluffing about its potential use of nuclear weapons against Ukraine. Natural gas leaks along Russian pipelines in the Baltic Sea have triggered questions of possible sabotage. Video from Sweden showed gas bubbles boiling to the surface today above the Nord Stream pipelines. Monitors registered explosions before the leaks. In Poland, the prime minister charged that it was clearly deliberate as he opened a new pipeline to bring in gas from Norway.
Today, we faced an act of sabotage. We don't know yet all the details of what happened, but we see clearly that this is an act of sabotage, an act which likely means a further step of escalation of the situation in Ukraine.
Other officials in the Baltics suggested that Russia damaged its own pipelines to increase pressure on Europe for supporting Ukraine. In Japan, a state funeral in Tokyo honored former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who was assassinated in July. He had already had a private funeral. Today's ceremony took place as thousands of protesters marched. They opposed Abe's pro-military record and the cost of the state funeral. Back in this country, jury selection began for Stuart Rhodes, founder of the far-right Oath Keepers, in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He and four others are accused of seditious conspiracy in one of the most serious cases arising from the riot. The trial in Washington, D.C. could take about 5 weeks. The U.S. Senate this evening advanced a bill that funds the federal government through mid-December and prevents a government shutdown this weekend. That came after West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin dropped his provisions to streamline and speed up permitting for energy projects. Republicans had objected to those provisions.
Our Democratic colleagues decided to put in extraneous partisan language, in fact, a poison pill. This extraneous poison pill is not related to keeping the government open. It was not negotiated across the aisle.
Because American families should not be subject to a Republican-manufactured government shutdown, Senator Manchin has requested, and I have agreed, to move forward and pass the recently filed continuing resolution legislation without the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2022.
Republicans have roundly criticized Senator Manchin since August, when he helped to pass a major budget and climate bill that he initially opposed. Americans on Medicare will pay lower premiums next year for Part B, covering most doctor's visits and outpatient care. The 3% decrease is the first in a decade. Program administrators said today that it's due in part to unexpected savings on a pricey Alzheimer's drug and to other unspecified factors. The Biden administration today announced a goal of ending hunger in the U.S. by 2030. The strategy calls for expanding benefits to help low-income Americans buy food and for promoting healthy eating and exercise. Also today, the U.S. Transportation Department gave final approval to building the first nationwide network of electric vehicle charging stations. The five-year project aims to install a station with high-speed charging ports every 50 miles along interstate highways. And on Wall Street, stocks had a mixed day as recession worries hovered over the market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost another 125 points to close at 29,135. The Nasdaq rose 26 points. The S&P 500 slipped 7. Still to come on the NewsHour, many Puerto Rico residents remain without power more than a week after Hurricane Fiona made landfall. Universities partner with community colleges to help more transfer students earn bachelor's degrees. Cheating allegations rock the chess world, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Protests led largely by women have spread in Iran and around the world, sparked by the death of a young woman in the custody of Iran's so-called morality police. Mahsa Amini was arrested because she was allegedly not wearing the required head covering. Now, thousands of Iranian women are saying enough is enough. Amna Nawaz has more.
Over the last 10 days, astonishing images have emerged from across Iran. Women burning their headscarves, cutting off their hair, and marching in the thousands, chanting death to the dictator. All to protest the regime's hijab requirement for women. In cities worldwide, solidarity marches have now sprung up, from Syria to Greece to California. But in Iran, the protesters are now facing a crackdown by authorities in the streets and online. For the latest on the ground, we're joined by special correspondent Reza Saya, who is in Tehran. Reza, thanks for joining us. It's now the middle of the night there. We know many of these protests tend to kick off once the sun goes down. So just tell us what the latest is, what you're seeing.
Amna, Tuesday was a religious holiday here in Iran, so the streets were very quiet. And it's important to point out that during these protests, during the daytime hours, things have been quiet, but it's when the sun goes down, it's when nightfall comes, that's when the protests happen. And when the sun went down on Tuesday night, the big question again, are protesters coming out? Obviously, there's severe restrictions here. The authorities have severely curtailed internet service. They've blocked messenger apps like WhatsApp that has roughly 50 million users here in Iran, blocked social media platforms like Instagram, another 50 million users. And what we've had to do is essentially drive around town to monitor the situation and also monitor secondhand accounts of protests that can't be independently verified, and monitor amateur videos posted online. Those can't be independently verified either. That said, over the past 24, 48 hours, seemingly, and we say this with caution, there has been a decrease in amateur videos posted online. That could be because people are having a tough time uploading videos, or it could be because the protests are dying down and abating, but it's unclear, and we can't report that with certainty.
So hard to come across reliable information there. We're so lucky we have you there. But Bressa, we should mention that the death of Mahsa Amini sparked what are now the first major protests nationwide in Iran since 2019. Those were sparked by a rise in fuel prices. And we know back then protesters were met by a brutal, brutal crackdown by the regime. You mentioned some of the ways they're curtailing communications, that they've responded in the streets. Is there a concern the longer these protests go on, the crackdown will also become more brutal?
I think there's a concern. And what's been interesting is that the response by the government has evolved over the past 12 days. Initially, soon after Mahsa Amini died and these protests started, the government and the leadership signaled somewhat that they sympathize with these protesters, or at least that's what they tried to convey to quell the protests. You had the supreme leader sending a senior aide to Mahsa Amini's home. You had President Ebrahim Raisi, while he was in New York last week for the UNGA, vowing to investigate this matter. When that didn't quell things, and when Ebrahim Raisi came back to Iran, that's when the crackdown got more severe. And obviously, over the past several days, according to human rights groups, more than 70 people killed, more than 1,200 people arrested. We're seeing more activists and journalists arrested. I personally know a fellow journalist who was detained for roughly 24 hours. So if indeed these protests are dying down, it could be because of the intensity of the crackdown. And it also could have something to do with the fact that these protesters, as valiant as they are, they don't have a leadership, they don't have a strategy. And how long can you sustain a fight with a security apparatus like Iran's if those are the circumstances you're facing?
Reza, the big question, of course, is what could this lead to? What do you think? Are you seeing something fundamentally different from previous protests that says these will lead to any change?
It's impossible to say what this will lead to. But what it drives home, once again, is that there's a lot of grievances here. There's a lot of anger and frustration. And any event can spark protests like this. This time, it was a woman's wish to express herself the way she wants to, and that sparked the protests. And what's interesting is riding this wave are other sectors of the population who are facing a struggling economy. There's joblessness here, unemployment, inflation. They've joined in, and you also have celebrities, actors, television hosts. They've joined in with their voices. That's something we haven't seen. But what we have seen in the past is, despite these voices, the government has the power. They have the weapons, and they've usually snuffed out these protests. I know a lot of people who don't like this government, both inside and outside Iran, want to push the narrative that this time it's different, that these protests are a legitimate threat to the government. And then you have the government pushing their own narrative that this is no big deal and things are going to calm down. We'll see what happens in the coming days.
That is special correspondent Reza Sayah joining us from Tehran tonight. Reza, thank you.
Now to the aftermath of Hurricane Fiona and its lasting impact on Puerto Rico. More than a week after the storm hit, the island electric utility says more than two-thirds of its customers' power has now been restored. But as Laura Barón-López reports, for the hundreds of thousands still in the dark, patience is wearing thin.
The hum of generators and the remains of people's lives stacked outside their homes filled the streets of Yauco in southwest Puerto Rico on Monday, 8 days after Hurricane Fiona made landfall.
We spent a week without water or power. The authorities haven't done anything for us. We are in rough shape. We lost everything.
That sense of desperation was also evident in the long lines at gas stations across the island. People continued to fill up cans to fuel generators powering their lights, water pumps, refrigerators, and more.
My generator and my fridge are broken. Many things broke down. I had to throw away over 100 pesos in food yesterday. That's really awful.
And there's growing anger with the island's power operator, Luma Energy, for moving slowly to restore power to the hundreds of thousands of people still in the dark.
You know how this goes. There's no money. And what happens to us? What happens with Luma? What happens with the governor? They do nothing. We are abandoned here. We don't even have water. They don't send water to our neighborhoods. Nothing.
Fiona hit 5 years after Hurricane Maria, a Category 5 storm with winds over 100 miles per hour, killing thousands. Fiona was just a Category 1 storm, but its flooding has devastated the island, washing away bridges, ruining homes and cars, and initially leaving more than a million Americans without electricity. In Caguas, in central Puerto Rico, Maria Nieves Martinez showed us around her house as she cleaned up what was left.
Everything got ruined. I don't have the boxes to throw them away because everything got ruined. All of this is garbage. Even this new air conditioner we bought that we were going to install got damaged. Everything got wet. This was too much.
Because of the continued blackouts, Martinez said her groceries have gone bad multiple times. And the power failures are hurting the island's most vulnerable residents, too.
Right now, on the eighth day, we still have hospitals without light, without electricity. They're running on a generator.
Jorge Rivera is a doctoral candidate in public health at the University of Puerto Rico. The island's healthcare had already been weakened by Hurricanes Irma and Maria, recent earthquakes, and the COVID pandemic. And now, Rivera says, many hospitals are relying on generators.
In Puerto Rico, there are more than 60 hospital centers where thousands of lives depend on or are connected to a ventilator or depend on medication that'll get ruined due to the lack of electricity or another service. For example, the dialysis centers. People who depend on the dialysis process depend entirely on electricity. If there's no electricity, that person can die.
For decades, Puerto Rico's power grid was run by state-controlled PREPA, whose infrastructure was badly damaged by Maria. Then in June of last year, a private consortium of American and Canadian companies called Luma took over operations and maintenance.
Nothing has improved, and we are paying a very expensive service. We are one of the most expensive services in the United States.
Israel Melendez Ayala is a historian and anthropologist in San Juan. Before Fiona even hit, he says that under Luma, his electric bill nearly tripled this year, and blackouts were frequent. He blames decades of corruption and negligence, including with PREPA, for the problems today.
When the government gave the contract to Luma, it was to improve the electricity services and to upgrade it, too. I mean, the electricity infrastructure of Puerto Rico is super old. I mean, when the corporate engineers came over here after Maria, they found that they were equipment of the 1940s. You know, this is the level of how old and the negligence from the government on the electric infrastructure in Puerto Rico.
Since Maria, the federal government has allocated nearly $13 billion for rebuilding the grid and public utilities. But so far, less than half of that has been spent by Luma and PREPA. Luma says it expects up to 91% of customers to have power by Friday, if there's enough capacity. Still, many in Puerto Rico expect a long road to recovery and to a more dependable power grid. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barón-López.
A short-term funding bill was unveiled late last night as the deadline to fund the federal government fast approaches. Preventing a shutdown is just one of a laundry list of items that lawmakers are scrambling to tackle before leaving town for the midterm election season. Our congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins is here with the latest. Hello, Lisa. So, Lisa, as we know, we're now just 3 days from the deadline for getting this funding thing figured out. Where does Congress stand?
Well, a funny thing happened just in the past couple of hours. This complicated knot of short-term funding seems to be untwisting itself in the Senate. As you reported earlier, Senator Joe Manchin, who was a key figure in this funding fight, stepped back and sort of removed his requirement for this short-term funding bill, which was, as we talked about last week, permitting reform. Especially dealing with energy permitting. He said he realized, he didn't say it this way, but essentially, Jude, he didn't have the votes. He realized he did not have the votes to get past a procedural hurdle tonight, did not have 60 votes. And in rather than hold up the short-term funding bill with his demand, he took that demand off. Now, if we look at the Senate floor right now as we speak, look at this. This is actually the quiet sign of progress. Look at that. No drama. But as you know, in the modern Senate, when it's quiet, usually that's a good sign. This is the Senate right now voting on the procedural vote to move to this funding bill. And let's talk a little bit about what exactly would be in this funding bill, because these must-pass vehicles are important policy instruments sometimes as well. Funds government through December 16th. Now, in addition to that, there's $12 billion in Ukraine aid. Some of that would go to the government of Ukraine. Some of it is military aid, all sorts of funding for Ukraine. Also, there's $3 billion in here that would be transferred to help with resettlement of Afghans who made it to this country. And then there's $20 million also for Mississippi water infrastructure. So, and also some housing money in this as well. So this is going to be a significant bill, not just for continuing funding of government, but for some specific problems.
But there are also the critics out there. What are they saying about this bill?
It's simple. Democrats and the Biden administration are very disappointed because the president's request for tens of billions of dollars to help with monkeypox and also the coronavirus is not in this bill. One of the reasons it's not is the president himself saying on 60 Minutes just over a week ago that, in his words, the pandemic is over. The White House went out to explain, well, that just means that we still have work to do. But Republicans are using that statement to say, we don't want to fund that.
So that is happening. And we know it's a busy week in general. Tell us now about the January 6th committee announcing today they're postponing or canceling tomorrow's hearing, which had been scheduled right up until now, and also where we stand on electoral reform.
One of those interesting days today on Capitol Hill, little bits of news that were important. The January 6th postponement. Let's read what the committee said in its statement about what they were doing. I know you reported this earlier, but they wrote that in light of Hurricane Ian bearing down on parts of Florida, we have decided to postpone tomorrow's proceedings. We're praying for the safety of all those in the storm's path. Now, one of the representatives on the January 6th Select Committee, of course, Stephanie Murphy, is a Florida representative. Her district is in the path, potentially, of the hurricane. It's more internal. It's not on the Gulf Coast. It shouldn't be a Category 3 hurricane that reaches there. But that was one factor. Another, Judy, though, my sources telling me, multiple sources telling me, the committee did not want to compete with potential cable news coverage of a hurricane bearing down. They wanted people to watch their meeting, their hearing, and they didn't think that tomorrow would be a good opportunity. They were concerned about safety, but they were also concerned about viewership. And that's one reason this will be postponed indefinitely. Mm. Not a lot of time before the midterms. We don't know if we will see this before the election.
And on electoral reform, what are you hearing about that?
A breakthrough on that as well today. In the Senate, the Senate Rules Committee passed its version of a bill that would reform that Electoral Count Act, trying to prevent a January 6th style run at overturning the election results. That passed 14-1. Only Senator Ted Cruz was a no. He said it's too federalizing of elections. But other than that, overwhelming support for it, including Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who came out today saying he supports that reform. I think we should watch for that to come together again after the midterm elections. One other note, we're watching for the Stock Act. That is a bill that would prevent members of Congress from trading stocks while in office. That could get a vote in the House this week, but the votes are very close on that. It's not clear it has the votes to pass.
A lot going on. You can tell we're getting close to Congress having to finish up.
Nothing like the clock to motivate Congress.
Nothing like the clock. Lisa Desjardins, thank you.
You're welcome.
As four-year colleges and universities look for ways to boost enrollment and reach underrepresented students, a growing number are focused on community colleges, transfer students who tend to be racially and socioeconomically diverse. At some of the nation's most selective colleges, transfer acceptance rates are now higher than first-year acceptance rates. But many community college students still struggle with the transfer process and completing their degrees. Special correspondent Hari Srinivasan reports for our series, Rethinking College.
Being a transfer student comes with struggles.
It's been a topic on social media, YouTube.
Not everyone is going to transfer well.
There are some problems with community college that I feel like
TikToks.
One, transferability.
And even an NBC sitcom.
Will you two be attending tomorrow's transfer ceremony to send off all the students leaving for so-called real schools?
The community college transfer process is often a bumpy ride.
Most students at a community college want to earn a bachelor's degree, but very few do. According to the Community College Research Center, out of every 100 students that want to, only 31 will transfer to a four-year institution, and only 14 will complete a bachelor's degree. One of the biggest hurdles, transferring credits.
Students typically lose about 40% of their credits when they transfer, often due to not taking the right courses for their majors or the four-year institution not accepting their credits. That hurdle and others mean very few transfer students, only 8%, are able to successfully complete one of the cheapest routes to a bachelor's degree, 2 years at a community college and 2 years at a four-year institution. 25-year-old Northern Virginia resident Jennifer Aguilar is on track to do just that.
I didn't actually have to fill out any applications to come to George Mason. They did all of the paperwork for me. All I had to do was just keep my good grades, meet with my advisor, sign up for classes, and they just pretty much took care of the whole thing.
Aguilar graduated last spring with an associate's degree from Northern Virginia Community College, or NOVA. She is now in her first semester at George Mason University and enrolled in a unique transfer partnership between the institutions called ADVANCE. The goal of the program is to help students like Aguilar who want to earn a bachelor's degree but may face some challenges getting there.
I didn't think I would be attending George Mason. It feels really unreal, to be honest. Right out of high school, I did want to go to college, but I just couldn't afford, not even community college. I just started working at various restaurants, and then it just got to a point that I just told myself, like, I need to do something with my life. I want to get an education. I've always had a dream of becoming a psychologist.
ADVANCE is a partnership between NOVA and Mason.
Launched in the fall of 2018, ADVANCE offers eligible NOVA students automatic admission at George Mason while they're completing their associate's degree.
I want you to know that we're with you every step of the way.
On a recent evening, ADVANCE students and their families gathered for a welcome event on the George Mason campus. ADVANCE is one of a small but growing number of dual admission programs around the country between two-year and four-year institutions designed to ease the transfer process. But NOVA and George Mason have implemented a number of other supports as well, including 87 academic pathways or majors that allow ADVANCE students to earn an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree in 4 years. That educational route saves ADVANCE students about $15,000 compared to students who spend 4 years at George Mason. Special financial aid for ADVANCE students helps reduce those costs even more.
At its heart, ADVANCE is about making transfer effective.
Ann Kress is the president of NOVA, the second largest community college in the United States, with more than 75,000 students across six campuses.
When you look at our partnership with Mason, even before ADVANCE, we sent the majority of our transfer students to Mason. When you looked at their ability to graduate within 2 years after transferring to Mason, it wasn't what it should be. And so that's really the nexus of ADVANCE. We're really giving students that transparent information so they know right from the jump when they sign up exactly what it's going to take to graduate in 2 years or less. And in fact, more than 90% of the ADVANCE students now do that.
The program, which is open to all NOVA students who meet eligibility criteria, including a 2.0 GPA or higher, has grown from about 150 students 4 years ago to 3,300 today. About 40% are low income, and a majority are students of color. 83% of advanced students are still enrolled at Nova 1 year after joining the program. That's 20 points higher than the national one-year retention rate for community college students. Nova students in the program have access to the George Mason campus, and some take classes there as part of their major.
Since I already had been here because of my previous Nova experience, I felt really welcome here. I knew my way around the library because I usually would spend my time there. And to be honest, like, I feel like this is my home now.
We do have students who are being integrated socially, academically, into the Mason culture before making that hard transfer.
Jason Dodge is the director of the advanced program. He and his team are employees of Nova and George Mason. The program is funded using state and tuition dollars from both institutions and contributions from donors.
We've moved from this idea of being transfer ready to being major ready. We know the differences between being ready to transfer with an English degree like I did from a community college to a university, and the differences with that and engineering are vastly different. That first year is crucial. And so we've done a lot within that first year to bolster the services that we have.
Those services include regular meetings with advanced coaches who help students navigate courses and offer supports for challenges outside of the classroom.
So what did you do like in that moment where...
Sabri Stewart is one of those coaches. Today, she works with more than 500 advanced students. But about 10 years ago, she was a student at Nova who found the transfer process difficult to navigate.
I was low income, so I really wanted to make sure the money that was going towards my classes was going to count and it would transfer to a bachelor's degree. I work with a huge population of low-income students at Nova, and I think it's not only understanding what that means from a financial aid standpoint, from a credit standpoint, but from a life standpoint. I understand what it's like for them to have to work to pay the bills or to contribute financially to their family, and the weight that they carry with that.
One of the most important ways students are supported is less visible.
We actually have enough courses to fill that pathway.
Faculty collaborations and meetings.
We needed to free up those 3 credits and wanted to give them more hands-on.
Right, like the one between Amy Richardson, an assistant professor of engineering at Nova, and Colin Regal, an associate professor of mechanical engineering at George Mason. These meetings have been essential. That's according to Gregory Washington, president of George Mason University. But he says it's not always easy.
It requires people to sit together in a room. It requires people on both ends to modify classes, to make them work together. So all of those hurdles are real ones. But if we provide the proper pathway, they actually can achieve and they will be successful. We can say that we've learned that.
Jennifer Aguilar says after she graduates, she hopes to get a master's and possibly a PhD.
There's not a lot of psychologists that speak Spanish. I can bring out my Spanish and help the community and just help people like me.
George Mason is currently expanding the advanced model to other community colleges around the state. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan in Northern Virginia.
One of the greatest chess champions of all time is accusing a fellow player of cheating, sending the chess world into chaos. William Brangham is back now to explain.
Judy, this is the biggest scandal the game has seen in decades. 31-year-old Norwegian Magnus Carlsen is the current world chess champion. And last night, he explicitly accused 19-year-old American Hans Niemann of cheating in past games and lying about it. In a recent match, Niemann beat Carlsen, and Carlsen then pulled out of the tournament, issuing some cryptic comments. But he was much more explicit in his statement yesterday, saying, quote, "We must do something about cheating, and for my part, going forward, I don't want to play against people that have cheated repeatedly in the past." He offered no further proof for his accusation. Niemann has admitted, though, to cheating when he was 12 and 16 in what he said were inconsequential games, but denies foul play when he played Carlsen or in any other major tournaments. So Here to unpack it all for us is Grandmaster Maurice Ashley. He was inducted into the U.S. Chess Hall of Fame in 2016. Maurice Ashley, it's an honor to have you on the NewsHour. Thank you so much for being here. Just to reiterate, there is no evidence that we have seen that Niemann actually cheated. But Carlson, in his statement that I read from, said that in the game where Carlson lost to this younger player, that Niemann seemed to not be concentrating at key moments and seemed to be playing far beyond his abilities. I wonder what you make of this whole accusation.
Well, this is an incredibly difficult situation for chess, for chess fans. Like myself, who have been involved in the game for four decades, to hear this kind of allegation is truly troubling. And coming from the world chess champion, maybe the greatest player who's ever touched a chess piece, that is truly troubling and devastating for the young man. Let's not make any bones about it. But what evidence does he have? He says that he can't reveal anything unless Hans gives him permission. Who has ever heard of an accuser asking for the accused to give permission for information against them? It is really a strange situation.
I mean, Carlsen, as you say, is the highest ranked player ever, but he's not infallible. He has lost. So there's either sort of two possibilities, it seems here. Either Niemann is the greatest up and comer in the game, or there was some foul play going on here. Where do you come down on that?
Well, let's be clear. Magnus has lost to players of Niemann's age, even younger than he is, in fact. Pragnananda, Magnus has lost to Pragnananda from India, 16 years old. You can lose despite being the greatest player in the game. It's possible to lose at chess in an individual game. Now, beating Magnus in a whole match, six or seven games, for example, that's a tall order indeed. So this one game, Magnus did not play very well and admittedly made some mistakes. So it's possible that in this individual matchup, he simply lost. But he felt, based on how Hans was acting and on some kind of data that he must have had from beforehand, that this particular game, it's one of those, he says, he doesn't think that the kid played above board.
I mean, underlying all of this is the fact that computer processing has gotten so good that, you know, with my little phone here, theoretically, using a good chess engine, I could beat Magnus Carlsen if I could rely on the computer. Again, there's no evidence that Niemann did any of that in this match, but given that that's a possibility, how is it that chess officials try to protect against that kind of cheating?
Well, this is a real issue for the International Chess Federation and for national federations worldwide. During a chess tournament, you are not allowed to bring in that trusty cell phone. And yes, programs now are so sophisticated that even Magnus couldn't take down your smartphone. However, they do have all these scanning devices, think TSA-like level, to check to make sure no electronic devices are being brought into the playing area, into the playing hall. But can you detect absolutely everything? That is the question. And even if a player does not have one of those phones, computer programs, what if they have a device hidden in their ear or somewhere on their person where somebody else on the outside, an accomplice, is watching the game live during a broadcast and is maybe sending some kind of signal? One buzz means a bishop, two buzzes means a knight. Players like Hans are good enough to figure it out on their own with just that scant information by itself. So that is the trick, to try to stop something like outside interference.
And again, we should say there are all sorts of wild rumors about different devices or signals that Hans might have been getting during the game. Again, no evidence of that. Carlsen, though, in that statement said that cheating is an existential threat to the game of chess. Do you believe that that's true?
Absolutely. I'm simply terrified for this game that I love so much and have been a part of for much greater than half of my life. The reality is, chess information is everything. I mean, we study chess books, we pore over encyclopedias of chess openings and study games from the past so that we can get key ideas in order to defeat our opponents. But if you can just get information at the click of a mouse or a buzz in your ear or somewhere else on your body, then you simply upend everything that is fair in the game. And if it's widespread, which, by the way, it's not just Hans. Other players have been caught in the past. He's not the only one. He's not the first. And unfortunately, probably will not be the last. And this presents a real threat to the purity of our game and moving forward, particularly online chess, where it has thrived. How do you police all of this? It's a big problem for the officials concerned overseeing all this. It's not something that will go away anytime soon.
All right. That is Maurice Ashley, chess grandmaster. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Like millions of Americans, Karen Robertson of Iuka, Mississippi, believed in conspiracy theories until one day she had an experience that convinced her to challenge her own beliefs. She spoke about that moment with student reporter McKenna Mead, who is with Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Youth Media Project. Their conversation is part of our Student Reporting Lab series on misinformation, Moments of Truth.
It was easier to believe that there was someone, something out there to get you, and that's why my life was as bad as it was. Hi, I'm Karen Robertson. I'm 30, and I'm a single mom. We're here to talk about the fact that I actually believed in conspiracy theories once upon a time ago.
Can you tell me, like, a couple of the conspiracy theories that you believed in?
There was one that I don't even know how to describe. Apparently, our birth certificates look like some type of like shipping things where we're selling stuff to China. Basically, China owns us, and there's a movie called Zeitgeist. They're trying to show you that like a lot of what you've been taught isn't factual. And then at some point, they go into 9/11 being an inside job. I kind of just straddled the fence on that one.
What resonated with you about the conspiracy theories?
I was in an abusive relationship that I didn't realize at the time was abusive. I was trying to make the world make sense, and it was easier to believe that it was a bad place and something was out to get you. And that's why my life was where it was at and as bad as it was than it was to realize I had made bad choices.
Can you tell me why you kind of went off and researched all of the things that you believed in?
There was a very specific night, actually, that caused this. This guy and I were talking, and he knew about all these different conspiracy theories that I did. Then towards the end of the conversation, he was like, get this, flat Earth. And I was like, I thought he was joking. And he's like, dude, there's evidence that the Earth is flat. A little while later, I saw him use a very, very hard drug. It made me realize if I'm thinking like someone like that, that I should reconsider my belief system. So the very next day, I actually searched how to disprove a conspiracy theory. A month, maybe even less, went by before my brain just kind of clicked and I was just like, all this is a bunch of hogwash.
If you could go back in time and you could talk to a younger version of yourself that believed all those years ago, what would you say to her?
I definitely would tell her that things are gonna get better. Because I think that was part of her problem. It's hard to change minds, but that would ultimately be really cool. If just a couple of people could decide to go look up something and challenge their own beliefs. That's gonna be the moral of my story, because when I challenged my beliefs, it changed my world and it made my life better.
What a great conversation, and we salute Student Reporting Lab's our own reporter, McKenna Mead. And on the NewsHour online, read about how building solar panels over California's canals is generating power and saving water as part of the state's effort to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2045. That is at pbs.org/newshour. And that is a NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon. We'll